Correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role.
www.d20radio.com.
You burst through the door, you find a small room filled with gold and jewels, and a red dragon. He starts to breathe. Save or die!
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classic Dungeons & Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Okay. So, Mike Carr, how are we doing today?
Doing great.
Awesome. Glad you can come on the show and answer a few questions for us today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and it's kind of fun to go back in the memory bank and see what comes up.
That's right. We want to hear what happened in the old days. So tell us, how did you get into the gaming hobby, and what games did you enjoy at first?
Well, as a kid, I was interested in what would be called family games, and that kind of took a turn into historical war games, and then ultimately the path that I went down with TSR. And in the eighth grade, I grew up in St. Paul, by the way, and that's how I happened to know Dave Arneson, who's also a native of St. Paul. But
right.
In the eighth grade, I was at a stationery store and saw an Avalon Hill war game and made the first purchase, and that's how I got into that. And in those days, Avalon Hill was publishing one game a year, which was just coming out every spring, so those of us in that rather niche hobby were always looking forward to what would come out next. And that's how I got started, and through that interest in historical games, I happened to meet Dave Arneson, who was several years older than I was, and he was very involved in miniatures and so on. One of the games we played in those days was World War II individual soldier miniatures. There was a rule set called Modern War in Miniature by Michael Korns that was a tabletop game, and we were buying model railroad buildings made by Kiebry in Germany, a lot of European town buildings and factories and that sort of thing, and then we'd play man-to-man combat with a referee and so on. So that was kind of one of the several precursors of role-playing that came out of that. We had a game that I and another friend, Siegfried Nelson, created based kind of off of that called Getaway. It was a cops and robbers game set in the state of Iowa, which was kind of a role-playing precursor as well. So that's how I got involved.
Cool.
What Avalon Hill war game was it, just out of curiosity?
The first game I got was U-Boat.
Ah. U-Boat. Ah, cool.
Which is great. It's three destroyers against three submarines, or you can go one-on-one, and so you can play with your buddy, or if you have a foursome, two can play the destroyers and two can play the submarines, and you simply have to cross the board with the submarines and get into the convoy, which is on the far end. Of course, the submarines are subject to being depth charged, and they can fire torpedoes. It's pretty rudimentary, but really kind of a classic game, and then that led into all the other Avalon Hill games, many of which I enjoyed.
You said that you met Dave Arneson in at one of the mini games. What game were you playing with him at the time? And
well, actually, we met. I was starting to get involved with a club called Aggressor Homeland, which was one of the larger national clubs for people who enjoyed war games, and I think he heard about me through that. Then, not long after that, the International Federation of Wargaming sprung up, so to speak, and that was a national club of interested people who were interested in war games, and through IFW is how I met Gary Gygax. So Dave invited me to come over. I went to his house, and he was very involved in miniatures, and he had graduated from the University of Minnesota, I believe, with a history degree in Napoleonic history as his specialty.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of 25-millimeter miniatures. Dave Wesley was a friend of his. They were playing tabletop games with 25-millimeter miniatures and so on. So that kind of got me into that world, and that's how I met Dave. So Dave and I were never close friends, but we were acquaintances from our St. Paul days and, friends, but not particularly close. I'd say the same with Gary. He and I were acquaintances through the IFW, and that's what eventually led to me to come to TSR and so on. Maybe getting a little ahead of myself here. But.
No, I just, did you see any signs of the early Dungeons & Dragons while you were playing those games with Dave? Or?
He'd been doing Napoleonic campaigns and so on. I can touch on that a little more as we go on, but with the chainmail rules that Gary Gygax had developed, and you know that's fairly well known how Dungeons and Dragons came out of the chainmail world. We were doing some of that sort of thing, and you know, I guess dabbling in different things. It was an interesting time because at that time there were very few published games, so there was a lot of, I think, imagination and creativity going on by gamers developing variants of one thing or another, or you know, developing something from their own imagination, or you know, being inspired by books or literatures, or in my case, the movie Blue Max, which you know, spawned the Dawn Patrol game. So, pretty interesting time, and you know, I guess I kind of looking back on that, if we'd known it was going to be the genesis of something big, maybe we would have taken better notes, but. So it was very interesting and very dynamic time, and really kind of fun. And you know, everything's a little bit larger than life when you're in high school, as I was when I got started, and so on. So it was great. And Dave was you know, a great friend and a mentor in a way in introducing me to this sort of thing, and you know, then early the Blackmore days and so on. So interesting and fun time.
Wow. And when you had a chance to game with Dave Arneson, how was he as a judge or a game master during the games you were playing?
Oh, he was quite remarkable and very imaginative. He not only was very well versed in Napoleonic history, but of course knew fantasy and science fiction to a strong degree. And that was, of course, the same with Gary Gygax as well. Background, they're very well read in that, and their creativity and so on as game masters was quite extraordinary. Dave had a Napoleonic campaign that encompassed a lot of the gamers in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and he did it twice over a number of years, and it was diplomacy-based, like the diplomacy game where you'd start out by having fleets and armies, and then he'd drop down into tremendous detail with the makeup of those areas, and you'd have national budgets depending on how much territory you had, and you'd apply those budgets to expend for troops, training of troops, equipping of troops with different types of weaponry, and raising cannon batteries of different things, and how much are you going to spend on cavalry, which are very expensive, of course. And then there was a naval element with ships and so on, and he ran this thing. And keep in mind, this was really before the age of computers where you could, you know, tally all things electronically. That was not the case in these days. He had lots of notes and was rolling dice, running this whole thing, and it was quite remarkable. I played as the head of the Barbary Pirates, and the setting was around 1800, and of course, the European situation very dynamic at that time, and there were players controlling each of the major countries of Europe, and in my case, North Africa. A lot of diplomatic interaction and ordering of armies, and then and fleets. And then when those would come together, according to the orders given to Dave and how he interpreted them, and so on, would result in battles which we play on the tabletop. Either you know, miniatures for land battles or sea battles, and that was kind of a genesis of the "Don't Give Up the Ship" rules. It kind of came out of that.
So there was an element of role playing in that.
Yeah, there was, and it was just fascinating. What was most remarkable was the scope of it. I mean, there was more than 20 people involved. I mean, he was having accepting orders from all these different people and their budgets and how many regiments are you going to buy and where are they going to be and that sort of thing. And then when it was campaign season, you know, where are you going to move your fleets and armies? And he would work all of that out, and you know, even down to single ships. So when somebody sent out privateers, which are individual vessels, to raid enemy commerce, I mean, he was dicing to see what encounters those ships would have and where, and then we could fight those out. Or you know, there were some quick and dirty rules for small things, but anything that was significant, you know, we'd play it out as a Saturday war game, and so it's quite remarkable.
You said there were 20 people that was keeping track of?
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it moved slowly over, you know, weeks and months, but it was a constant source of activity for all of us involved. And, you know, I was commanding, or I was in charge of the Barbary Pirates, which were kind of a marginal element in the world situation in those days, of course. But I was also helped the player, Tim Kirkpatrick, who was the Emperor of France. I was his naval commander, so I was, you know, in charge of the French fleets, you know, under his command and so on. So it was quite a thing. And there were two players playing England. There was France, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, Spain. Of course, I was running afoul of Spain from time to time since I was in North Africa. Jim Barber played the Pope. He was the Papal States. There was Tuscany, Lombardy, Austria, Hungary was obviously a power in those days, Prussia, so on. And then, interestingly, in the second campaign, to simulate the role of America, Dave had Gary Gygax in Lake Geneva, far off Lake Geneva, 300 miles from the Twin Cities, play the Americans. Of course, they had a small but very stout navy in those days, and they would occasionally show up, kind of be like a wild card showing up in European waters, and then Dave would say, you know, these are the errors the Americans have, and they would, you know, get out of the way, everybody. So they had the best navy. So kind of a fascinating milieu that he did two times, and you know, ran it all by hand, and that's just remarkable because of the scope of it and the amount of detail, just stunning. So I have high respect for Dave from that alone. We also ran a couple of interesting role-playing events. We had a game called Braunstein, which I believe was an offshoot of something that Dave Wesley, his friend, had done. But we had it was kind of an all-day Saturday from morning to night interactive role-playing situation and game with different roles being played by each of us, and we'd come in and Dave would confer with us individually, what do you want to do now, what are you going to do, so on. The situation was that it was a coup d'etat in a banana republic. If you're familiar with the board game Junta, which came out later, which is a great game in itself, this was kind of that, a role-playing version of that situation. I remember that in this coup d'etat, I was the Air Force commander, and this was such a backwater little country in the capital city. You know, I had a helicopter. I was the Air Force. I had a helicopter. That was as good as it got for them. And, you know, everybody was kind of hamstrung by a lack of resources, and there was El Presidente, and, you know, who controlled the radio station. And, you know, it was just a fascinating day-long event. I don't even remember how it all turned out, but I know it was just very engaging and, you know, still very fondly remembered in my mind. And then he did it again, and he called it Brownstone this time. And it was a one-day, all-day Saturday, kind of a Wild West town situation. We each had different characters, and I was the Reverend Dwayne DeTruth. I was the Reverend, head of the church there, and a former gunslinger who'd gone straight, and that was my role. And of course, the railroad guys were there coming to put the railroad through, and there was somebody playing the Indians, and the beleaguered sheriff, and the mayor, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, quite a... Again, a pretty memorable day of gaming under Dave's guidance. So,
well, you put a cleric character in the first Blackmoor campaign. Would you say that the character that you played in that Wild West game was kind of a sort of a precursor for your Blackmoor cleric?
I think that's purely coincidental, but I was in the early Blackmoor campaign or world. I played, I guess, the original cleric character, and had a small chapel there, and would go off on a few adventures with others, and, you know, it was all kind of taking shape at that point, and, you know, kind of fascinating and fun. I don't have a lot of cogent recollections, I guess, of those days, but it was a fun time, and kind of interesting, as you can imagine.
Well, what abilities did your cleric character possess, if you recall, that may have been different from what the cleric eventually became in Dungeons & Dragons?
In this case, my character was pretty low level. It was pretty basic stuff. I had the ability to fight. I think I carried a mace. And as far as abilities, they would come to me, the characters would come to me for low-level healing. I couldn't raise the dead or anything like that, but had the ability to do that, and I think there were one or two other spells that might be of marginal usefulness in our adventuring.
Well, you've already talked about how you met Gary, What role would you say Gary Gygax played in your development and publishing of the Fight in the Skies game?
Well, he was instrumental in that. In those days, as I mentioned, there were very few games being published. And one of the things the IFW did, to their credit, was to promote interested gamers who were really of all ages. I was on the younger end of the scale, to come up with new games and kind of maybe alleviate the logjam of only one game coming out per year. So Gary was behind the formation of the War Game Inventors Guild, which was one of the number of interest groups or societies within the IFW. And he heard that I had come up with the idea for a board war game, which I called Fight in the Skies. Incidentally, was inspired by the movie The Blue Max, which had quite an impression on me, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to, if you could create a game where you kind of get the feel of the aerial action from that movie and so on. So that was really the impetus behind that. And he said, you know, I'd like to take a look at this, and he said, this looks pretty interesting. I think this is something that maybe you should publish yourself initially, which I did. The first edition was 25 copies. The second edition, after received some good acceptance, was 50 copies. The third edition was 100 copies, and prevailed upon my dad, who looked at the 3M company, to run off copies at work, which he did, of some of the charts and so on, which we used. And so he had been, Gary had been, you know, instrumental in promoting this. And then later on, subsequently, after it still seemed to have some momentum, he approached Don Lowry, who was the owner and publisher of Gaidon Games, and said, you know, you should take a look at this game from Mike Carr, and they ended up publishing it. That was the fourth edition, and that was, I think, about 1,000 copies.
Didn't it eventually get renamed as Dawn Patrol?
Yeah, TSR did the fifth edition in 1976, which was right about the time I was coming to work there. And then they did a sixth edition, changed the box from blue to red and put it in upright, so show off better at hobby shops. And then the seventh edition was Dawn Patrol. They renamed it, got that as a trademark, and then started billing it more as a role-playing game, even though it's kind of a hybrid in that regard. So Gary's very instrumental in in getting that going and encouraging me and so on in the early days. And it came out of that War Game Inventors Guild as part of IFW.
Now, you said you knew Dave and Gary from the group there, and that eventually you got hired by TSR. When was that?
I came to work in March of 1976. And
76.
I'd known both of them, and it was kind of interesting. You know, Dave said, well, we're getting up a game company in Lake Geneva and going to publish some rule books. Of course, it was Tactical Studies Rules was the early version. And again, I think probably don't need to go over that ground. That's probably pretty well known, but that's how it came about. I graduated from college in 1973. I have a degree in history, and was hoping to be a teacher, and there really were no teaching jobs at that time. We were in the middle of a recession, kind of like currently, and didn't have a lot of prospects. I worked as worked in the restaurant business as my college job to help pay tuition, and this was for the Ground Round chain. And I went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to work as a manager trainee and assistant manager, and still kept my interest in gaming and was in touch with nominally at least Gary and Dave. And Gary contacted me and said, we got this game company started up, and Don Kay had passed away, different direction, and Dave Arneson had gone to Lake Geneva to be involved in it. And he said, you know, you've got a little, you know gaming, and you've got a little managerial experience. If, you know, helping run a restaurant counts for anything, and maybe it does a little bit, but he said, we'd like to have you come and work for us in Lake Geneva if you're interested. So that's kind of how it came about.
So what kind of salary did they offer to you, Darwin,
well, interestingly,
if anything?
I was young and single at the time, so my financial requirements were minimal, fortunately. In the restaurant business, I was getting $205 a week, and Gary offered me $110 a week to come to work at TSR, which was almost a 50% pay cut, but it was obviously going to be a lot more fun than working in a restaurant and being involved in creative sort of things. And he said that we'll also give you some stock in the company, and you'll have the opportunity to buy some additional shares. And if this thing catches on and goes places and becomes something, obviously those shares will be worth something, which absolutely turned out to be true in the long run. So it was a great opportunity, and being single and young, I was able to with no particular ties to anywhere, and I was eager to get out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after 2 years, and so that's what led me to Lake Geneva. The rest
so
of
it was kind of a leap of faith then.
Yes, it was. But I knew Gary and I knew Dave, and they introduced me to some of the other people there, and it was great. And Lake Geneva, an interesting place to move to. I had visited there as an early attendee of some of the Gen Cons prior to that, so I was familiar with the town and knew it was, be an interesting and fun place to live, and that was absolutely true. In fact, I still live in Wisconsin now, 40 miles from Lake Geneva, so that's what led me to Wisconsin, and here I still am.
So what kind of different things they have you do around TSR? What kind of jobs?
Started out pretty, pretty informally. I've worked kind of as general manager for a little while, helping oversee some of the various activities. Brian Bloom was also there, and he was, on the business side. Gary was doing more of the creative stuff. Later then went into become the games and rules editor, which morphed into becoming the vice president of production, which involved overseeing the editing, some of which I did myself, and also supervising other editors. The graphics, I didn't oversee the artists, but I was involved in consulting with them for graphic elements. And, of course, it wasn't a big graphic staff in those days. Dave Sutherland, later Dave Trampier, came on board as VP production, also involved in the layout of the printed materials and the proofreading of such, and working with the printers, getting printing quotes and that sort of thing, deciding which printer we were going to use, and also consulting on packaging and the design of the box covers and that sort of thing. Later, when TSR was getting into manufacturing, they asked me if I would be vice president of manufacturing. They wanted to take in more of the production and assembly themselves. Mm-hmm. Initially, I turned it down, but Gary said, no, we really want you to do this, because I was getting more away from the creative side. So I did. And then eventually that went in a different direction, and my last duties with TSR were as a children's book writer and worked on Endless Quest books. I wrote the Robbers and Robots book, which they put attached to the Top Secret game and that sort of thing. So it was, back into the creative thing. So it kind of came full circle from that.
Wow. Circle.
But over this 7+ years, pretty fascinating mixture of duties and projects and working with a ton of different people. And also TSR was moving out from, the house that they had used as an office, which is on Broad Street there across from the Pizza Hut, moved into the hotel downtown, which was a 3- or 4-story building, and more offices, and the Dungeon Hobby Shop on the main floor. So you can imagine, as all of this kind of unfolded, pretty remarkable thing to be a part of, and quite gratifying.
So you're there about 7 years or so.
Yeah, from March of 76 to July of 1983.
Okay. And over the course, while you were employed at TSR, repeating myself, were there times when, the creative side clashed with the business side? And how did that kind of play out?
Yeah, there definitely were from time to time. I'd say it could go either way, and it did go either way in some cases. The company was founded by a bunch of gamers, and as things gathered momentum and became bigger, and the business continued to grow and so on, there were non-gamers who came in, as you'd expect, that to help run things and operate things, and of course business decisions had to be made in some cases, and in those cases could go either way. So did business considerations heavily or negatively impact the creative side? I don't think so, but that was sometimes a factor. I guess a good example would probably be Gen Con. Gen Con started out as a small and pretty informal sort of thing, and Gary had founded it, so obviously he was attached to it. I was going every year, so I liked it. The other gamers involved thought it was a great thing. But as that grew and as TSR grew, every year the amount of work involved in just staging the convention and preparing for it and handling the registration and the advertising and then running the thing, which basically took a week. The convention was maybe 3 days, but everybody had to get off work to get everything ready, and the non-gamer people were involved in watching the door and signing up new attendees and et cetera, et cetera. So it basically everything came to a standstill. Now, eventually, as things got bigger and Gen Con got bigger, it's a question, is this really worth all the tremendous amount of time? For a while, they had Dave Conant and Skip Williams, two guys, full-time employees year-round, you know, just running the convention and all of the stuff. And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger. So that was a question, I think, of, you know, is it actually worth it? And if you look maybe from the dollar standpoint, it would be questionable. But from the goodwill standpoint, a tremendous value. And you can't always put a dollar amount on goodwill. So
I can't buy that kind of goodwill. Pardon me? I said you can't buy that kind of goodwill.
That's true. And it would also bring people to Lake Geneva. And, you know, they come to the Dungeon Hobby Shop and spend money and et cetera, et cetera. So I think to their credit, I mean, they never did, you know, get rid of the convention. It was stayed a part of TSR all the way through, you know, their eventual acquisition by Wizards and so on. And, you know, nowadays, you know, Peter Adkison from Wizards kept Gen Con as the one asset that he wanted when he sold that company. So, you know, he's as much of an angel nowadays as Gary was in the early days. So I guess that's a pretty good example of you know, how the fun and the gamer mentality may have clashed with what would be the cold sense of business and looking at the pure dollars and cents.
Yeah, I can see that. How involved were you in the, like, the war games, the board miniatures aspect of TSR, and which one do you really prefer?
I worked with both the historical games and the fantasy games. I enjoyed, you know, working with both as an editor and a play tester. I think ultimately I, you know, preferred playing historical games. I don't have a great or deep interest in fantasy or science fiction, still don't to this day, but I realize how popular it is with so many people, and obviously that was really the bread and butter that propelled the growth of TSR. So I think that was a great combination, and, you know, obviously kept it interesting going back and forth and working with projects of both. And ultimately, Dungeons and Dragons and the role-playing games, as you'd expect, became the driving engine of TSR. And there was still release of historical games and hopes of establishing a presence in that business, which were never fully realized, but still it was something that was of interest. And, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to, is it a good game? Is it a fun game? And, you know, regardless of the setting, and if you can capture that magic, so to speak, if you pardon the pun, even in a historical game where people really are fascinated by it, intrigued by it, and enjoy it, and the interaction is good and so on, you know, that's going to make a successful title. So that was kind of interesting from that standpoint. In my own case, I think, and maybe it's hampering me a little bit now in talking about specifics of D&D, which I know is the focus of your blog and so on, but I think what helped me be a good editor for all of these fantasy materials was the fact that I was not a diehard Dungeons & Dragons player like so many of the others were. And when, you know, Gary or Dave would write rules, you know, they were sometimes assuming that the reader, you know, was conversant with the background of, you know, whether it's armor class or anything like that. And I was looking at it kind of from a standpoint of, if I'm coming into this cold and I don't know anything about this, you know, what in the rules will I need to make sure is included so that somebody who's new to this can get a grasp of it and hopefully understand it and do it correctly the way the designers or the creators of a module or whatever, you know, intended. So I think I brought a lot of value in that standpoint, hopefully.
So it must have been kind of odd for you to be part of the Dungeons and Dragons phenomenon.
And oh, it was.
Being
it was. Absolutely.
Both part of it and yet not quite completely in it.
Yes, it was. I always, even to this day, I tell people I had a ringside seat for the whole Dungeons and Dragons phenomenon, which is very true, you know, starting with the fact, coincidentally, that I happened to be from St. Paul, which was where Dave Arneson originated, and that I happened to know Gary Gygax before this all got rolling. And so I'm a very fortunate guy in terms of, you know, seeing all this up close and personal and knowing the people involved and, you know, having a small role in the development of things. And, you know, it's something I look back very fondly upon. And in those days, I was in my 20s, and it was, you know, just a very exciting and dynamic time, and something I enjoyed greatly. And I enjoyed living in Lake Geneva and, you know, participating in all the Gen Cons and all the different activities, including playtesting, and we'd play weeknights, other games, including Frightened Skies or Dawn Patrol occasionally, and it was a great and fun experience, believe me. And anytime you get paid for doing something that is fun, it doesn't get much better than that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Definitely. And you were the author of one of the, I guess, seminal adventures for Dungeons & Dragons B1, In Search of the Unknown. How did that come about as far as, you being tapped to write that and its general development?
Well, as games and rules editor at that time, I could see it opening a module with the basic game that really laid out the whole structure of how do you create a dungeon and how do you populate it, and in what ways do you as a dungeon master or game master conceptualize this sort of thing and come up with the scenario or the legend behind it, that was really the impetus behind that. And I told Gary and Gary Gygax and Brian Bloom, I said, this is something that would be good, because they were hoping to put something in there. It was kind of nebulous at that point, so I can't say that was my idea, but I said, I'd like to take a stab at this, and I think this is something I can do. And the fact that I'm not deeply into the Dungeons & Dragons world, but yet I have a full understanding of the concept and how it works, I'd like to do this. So that was... they were agreeable to that, and that was really the impetus behind it. And in creating it, I tried to, again, lay out as much detail as possible to kind of give people a feel. If you're going to do this yourself, here's an example, and in fact, here's the structure framework, and you can, plug in the treasures, you can plug in the monsters where you want, and it's structured for you, but you can kind of put your own stamp on it. And then after you've played this and run this, you'll hopefully know the ropes, and then just you'll be off to the races in terms of creating something like that on your own. So that was really the idea, to provide something that fledgling dungeon masters, people who had never known what a role-playing game was, could take this and at least have a clue on how to proceed with it. And hopefully I succeed in that regard.
Yeah, I think so. Was the background of the module from maybe, was that based on something you had already gamed, or was it just kind of made up whole cloth specifically for the module?
It was made up whole cloth. The point that I made in there is you can take this now, once you've become a dungeon master and you're creating your own situation, you can use this if you like as part of your world, and it can be off in one corner or whatever, or a reference point and so on. But no, it was created specifically for for that module and out of whole cloth, as you say.
Well, if you were tapped to do that module again today, was there be anything that you would do differently if you look back on it and maybe go, dang, I should have done it this way or something else?
I think I'd do it pretty much the same. I did a lot of brainstorming and talked to a few other people and tried to lay out all of the different things, some of the surprise elements and so on. And then, getting it, conceptualizing it into the 8.5 by 11, so we could do a map in a rectangle, and the dungeon has stronghold has two levels, and how do they fit one on top of the other, and a little bit of architectural consideration there, sort of thing, and then coming up with a plausible legend or story about how the characters came to this place, and who did this belong to, and why were they not there, and what might be inside, and that sort of thing. So I tried to touch all those bases, and I believe I did so. And then we were within 24 or 28 pages. I don't remember what the length of it was, and you have to get all the descriptions in there and so on, but I think it eventually worked out pretty well.
Yeah, one of the things I always liked about B1 is that Zelagar and the quote-unquote background characters who created the fort, it was always given very vague as to, were they... I always felt like they were neutral to evil, but there was nothing absolute about it. You were always kind of left to make that up yourself, and I thought that was great.
Absolutely, and it sounded like in their career they'd been opportunistic, they'd been lucky, they'd earned what they had, and they'd gone off adventuring together and become great friends. And I think I also maybe hinted that maybe someday they're going to come back, and maybe you've got your player characters have moved into this place, and now it's their they've kind of become squatters there, and once they've cleaned out the place. And, of course, the Dungeon Master could bring back Rogan and Zelagar, and you could have all sorts of things occur as a result of that, too, as well.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I created those names, just kind of made them up, and subsequently, later in my life, I met a friend named Rod Rogan, spelling it wrong, so... that was when he introduced himself to me and told me what his name was. I cracked quite a smile, and it was kind of an amazing coincidence.
Okay, cool. What other modules were you involved with, maybe as an author or an editor, while you were working at TSR?
I was involved in editing a number of the early modules that followed the B1 and went into the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, and that were done by Gary and others, which was a pretty interesting process. I remember the Tomb of Horrors was involved in that, and I was reading through the thing, and I thought, man, nobody's going to get very far into this thing, you know, before they're in trouble, because it's just really pretty stiff.
Real meat grinder
for the players, yeah. So that was, I think, one of the most challenging and interesting. So that was one example. I did a number of the involved in, I think, the Vault of the Drow and some of the early modules, which later on, as I moved on to other duties, other people were involved in editing and so on. So it was, I'd say, the early ones. For the Top Secret game, I was involved in editing that, and the Top Secret game came in from a gentleman named Merle Rasmussen. He was from Iowa, and the idea and background that he provided was pretty good, but from a game standpoint, it needed a lot of work, and so we were pretty involved in kind of reworking that, and to his credit, he was very amenable to that and provided further input, and we did a lot of play testing. And interestingly, the cover of that game, we were trying to decide graphically what do we want to do. Well, I had a passport, and we got some Cougarans, and somebody had a, I think it was a Beretta pistol or whatever that we put on this on the cover there. And we got one of the gals who worked in the office to get a slit skirt, and we took a picture of her lower half with the skirt and high heels, and kind of arranged them out, for the box covers. We had a Eurail pass showing in there, which is from my trip to Europe in 1976, and kind of arrayed this as kind of the tools of the trade for a secret agent, and I think we carried it off, considering we were on a very, very limited budget. So,
was a collaborative effort.
Yeah, it was. And we were doing things on a shoestring, instead of hiring a design studio, which obviously we couldn't afford, we had to come up with this idea. But that's really a fun, I'm sure everybody that's gone through high school or colleges, had challenges like that where you just got to see what you got at hand and, see what you can come up with, put it together. So we carried that out. But the Top Secret game was pretty interesting project to edit and be involved with. And as one of the offshoots, one year for Gen Con, Corey Kobernick and I created we're going to run a Top Secret event. We created a scenario which we called Lady in Distress, which was a cruise ship which had been overtaken by terrorists, and then the player characters were going to be coming out of an airplane, paraglide down onto this more or less abandoned and taken over. The passengers had been let go, so you've got a situation where just the terrorists are in charge of this vessel that now the good guys are going to come and try to take back, and that was the scenario. We ran it at Gen Con and a number of different groups. It was pretty fun and challenging, but interestingly, during the development period for that particular module, I needed a cruise ship plan. So I went to the travel agency in Lake Geneva to see what brochures they had, and the travel agency said, well, we've got a number of cruises, we represent different lines, and here's an example of a brochure, and it was the Achille Laurel, Italian liner. So we took it back to the graphic arts department. I played around with it, and Corona, MS, we call it the MS Corona, our ship, our fictional vessel. And we used a lot of the floor plan of the Achille Laurel. We took out a deck or two. The real ship had six decks, and ours had four. Obviously, we could only fit so much space in, and how do you portray all of that? And that became the module. And several years later, as you and your listeners may well be aware, the real Achille Laurel was attacked by, I believe, Palestinian terrorists, and a gentleman named Klinghoffer was killed, one of the passengers. Mm-hmm. And when the news of that you know, hit the airwaves, and I saw that the real Achille Lauro was involved in a real-life incident involving terrorists, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what a bad coincidence. Well, we had never identified that vessel or anything. However, one day, in the midst of that, or shortly after, I was passing through the Dungeon Hobby Shop on the way to my office, and Ernie Gygax said, we got a call from the FBI, and you're supposed to, you know, they asked about this cruise ship thing and role-playing top secret game and stuff, and it, we, you know, so we just call them as a game and stuff, and, you know, they want you to contact this agent, and I thought, oh, man, I don't even want to go open this can of worms or anything like that, so nothing ever came of that, and of course, it was purely coincidental, and a little bit chilling in the fact that, you know, we're trying to create a role-playing game to simulate real life and espionage and that sort of thing, and that
Yeah, what are the odds?
Exactly, exactly. Another interesting thing related to Top Secret, I was, one of the ideas, this never became a product, but we thought of doing a campaign setting. We'd have major European cities, and you could, player characters could go from city to city, and we would provide some background on each of those places, and Zurich, London, Barcelona, Madrid, Rome, etc., Tel Aviv, Istanbul, etc., etc., and we were going to, part of the idea was we would create standardized buildings that could be used as settings for Top Secret, and you'd have a generic warehouse and generic office building, and et cetera, et cetera. So I was on a trip to France, and I was at the casino in Monte Carlo. Obviously, Monte Carlo, highly desirable location for secret agents, as proven by the fact that it appears in a lot of Hollywood movies over the years.
Yeah, purely there for research, right?
Yes, and I was sketching. I was sketching the floor plan of the casino, at least what I could see from the public areas and the gallery. It's just a beautiful old, you know, classic, you know, building from the 1800s and legendary. It's been in James Bond and other, you know, historical movies over the years. I see it from time to time. And of course, security came along and wanted to know who was I and what was I doing and why was I drawing the floor plan. And would you come with us, please, sir? So fortunately, before I had left Lake Geneva, we had drafted a letter on PSR letterhead that I had with me explaining that you know, I was doing research for this top secret role-playing game. And we even had, if I recall, we even had a version in French prepared by somebody that was fluent in French. Oh. So I was able to show that to them, and they conferred a bit. And they said, all right, you know, basically, you can't do that. You know, you're in a secure area. And obviously, what I was doing was questionable in their eyes.
Well, yeah.
You know, so please leave, and you know, we're going to keep this drawing. And okay, fine. I'm just glad to be out of there without any further ramifications. So
just let me go.
Yeah.
That's going the extra mile. You know, for okay. Role playing game research there.
So, all right. Thinking back in the days when you were working for Gary,
sure.
And Dave, did you? What did you think about the? Or is it true about how there were some TSR employees living in a house? Did Gary actually do that for some employees?
Well, the office was in a house. I was in an apartment. I don't really know exactly what you're referring to, but the early office was a house that was rented out, and there were the upstairs bedrooms became offices, one of which was mine, and Tim Kask had the Dragon office there, and Gary Gygax was in one of the larger rooms, and Brian Bloom in the other, and downstairs was the kitchen was the shipping department. Stock was stored in the basement. You can imagine that was quite a fun situation.
Yeah. Well, I was referring to an earlier interview we had with Jean Wells, and she said that Gary had offered some people to stay in the house because they were unable to find an apartment or something at the time.
Well, yeah, it might have been on a temporary basis. Over the years, I had an apartment. I was in a fourplex and shared my apartment with a succession of TSR employees. Kind of a fascinating situation. And I had... a number of ways. Dave Sutherland, the artist, was my first roommate, and Tim Jones, a young man who was involved in editing the rules and so on, was. And then Harold Johnson, who had quite a history with TSR subsequently. Jim Quinn, who's still a friend of mine to this day, was my roommate for a while. He was working in advertising and distribution. And then John Danovich, who was working in sales. So, and there were a number of residences around town where one or more. That was, again, part of the fun of those days. I think what she may have been referring to is when she first came to Lake Geneva, she may have been temporarily housed.
Oh, maybe.
Until she could find a place. Lake Geneva is very seasonal. It gets jam-packed, crowded in the summer, especially on the Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day weekends, and then this time of year. And once fall comes in the winter, it empties out and becomes like every other small town in America. So it's very, very seasonal in terms of getting lodging and that sort of thing. Part of the charm of the place.
Huh. Okay, cool. Liz?
Okay. You talked a little bit about your Fight in the Skies game, and we mentioned about how they had renamed it Dawn Patrol. Is it true that there is still an avid following for the game and a newsletter being published about it, even to this day?
Yeah, yes, that's true. The original game, as I mentioned, came out of my days with the IFW, and in those days they had interest groups and a number of societies. Castle and Cookie Society was one of the ones that came along later. There were Stalingrad Society interest groups related to particular games. And in 1969, we formed the Fight in the Skies Society, published our first newsletter, Aerodrome, we called it, number one, in June of 1969. And that society is still going today. We had about a five-year hiatus, I think 1987, 92, but some avid players said, would you mind if we tried to get this group back together? And I said, absolutely, as long as I don't have to do all the work, like I did in the early days. Well, we'd like to have a newsletter again and resurrect the Aerodrome, and that was about issue 87 or 88, and now today we're up to issue 157. In fact, the next one that's going to come out, hopefully in the next couple of months, is going to be issue number 158. The game was never a huge seller, probably sold about 50,000 copies over its lifetime, but had a very small and devoted following, which continues to this day. And pretty interestingly, now with Google and search engines, every once in a while we get an inquiry. Somebody types in Dawn Patrol and finds out that there's the Fight in the Sky Society, which was the original name, still exists. And they get an email from somebody saying, man, I can't believe that this game is still around. Anybody still playing it? We had a blast playing this game. In high school, we played it every Saturday, and all my buddies liked it. And so that was a niche compared to the many more number of people involved in role-playing games and Dungeons & Dragons, but it's still kind of fun to know that people like that. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we had a all-day gathering in Chicago. We had a dozen people come and play, and we have a spring mini convention in Milwaukee. So yeah, still continued to be played and enjoyed. And now with desktop publishing, this formerly mimeographed or ditto reproduced newsletter, looks like a doggone magazine, thanks to modern technology. So we've got historical articles in there, game-related stuff, and there's still hope that we'll do an eighth edition of the game sometime in the future. So
that would be great.
Yeah,
still got legs. So the fact that it's been sustained over decades, pretty interesting. We published our in 2009 our 40th anniversary issue of the Aerodrome, which was number 155. So
wow,
that was I think 40 pages. So it's kind of fun. It's pretty gratifying as a designer to know that somebody still cares about what you did then, and I still enjoy playing it. And we've got a group of players in the greater Milwaukee area, and including some new people, and they're enjoying it, and I'm enjoying it too. So
cool.
It's kind of a fun thing that's been surprisingly sustained over all these years.
Okay, so what would you say are the elements of Dawn Patrol that make it appealing to players, even now?
Several aspects, I think, have been responsible for the success of it and the popularity of it. First of all, any number can play. You need a minimum of four, but you can play with five or seven, and it's interesting. I particularly enjoy playing with 10 or 12, and you split roughly equal number on each side. It's four against three or five against five or what it happens to be. Also, we've got random determinants for the game situation, so no two games are ever the same. There's lots of variables, are there clouds or no clouds, who's on which side, what month of the war it is, and that would determine what kind of airplanes are available, which again you roll randomly to see what you get. Is it a low or high altitude game or medium altitude, which means 6, 12, 15,000. Are there balloons, observation balloons involved? Is either side of a mission? We were kind of simulating all the various types of aerial activities of World War One, and it keeps it very interesting. So no two games are the same and can be pretty challenging. Also, in the quasi-role-playing aspect of it, players create pilots, fictional pilots, and rosters of those pilots for being assigned to particular aircraft. And so when you get a Sopwith Camel, you bring out your Sopwith Camel pilot, Lieutenant John Doe, or whoever it happens to be. And if that pilot survives the mission, you tally as a mission. If you score a victory, you score that as a kill. You can become an ace. We've got all the World War One medals in there that you can win through heroism or service and so on. So, you know, it's not a true role-playing game in the full sense that so many others are, but you still get that element, and people enjoy that. And
you can level up.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very playable. It's, you know, we're simulating aerial flight in a very simple way. I mean, it's developed by a guy in high school, and so it's, you know, it's a fly-and-shoot game, but it has a richness of detail. There's very detailed critical hits that can go on with different things that might happen to your engine or your tail structure and affect the maneuverability of your aircraft or your trailing smoke. You know, you get a gun jam and all these sorts of things that kind of add to it. So it's deep enough to be challenging, but yet the basic mechanics are pretty simple. So I always tell people, I can teach you to play this in 20 minutes, and, you know, you can get going. And, you know, that's true. And then as you learn more and more, you kind of get the three-dimensional appreciation, which only comes through time. And then you start to learn when you should maybe exit the combat and head for a cloud or something, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of, I think, elements to it that really, you know, collectively make it appealing and on a continuing basis. And, of course, anybody who does role-playing knows if once you've got these characters, in this case, the pilots on a roster, you start to get attached to them, and you want to build them up, and the more you play, the more you build them up, and the more fun it is. So, you know, that's from that standpoint, it's got some continuing appeal, I think.
So when you were in TSR and first started out, you know, you were writing the modules like B1, and eventually you went on into doing the editing and overseeing a lot of what other people were doing. Did you miss the module writing aspect, or, you know, did you still feel that you were being sufficiently creative, you know, but just on a larger scale?
I would say I missed it a little bit, but I'm not the font of ideas that some of the other people are. Obviously, Gary Gygax, Dave Arneson, Jim Ward is another great example of a guy who's just full of great ideas and has a boundless imagination. And, you know, those are the people that are really more creative than I am. So I was happy to do what I did, and I think I had some good ideas that came to fruition, and a few more that were on the drawing board or, you know, didn't happen to see the light of day. But being an editor is also creative, and you get to work with not only these individuals, but with, you know, the result of their imagination and so on. So keeping that involvement, that level, very fascinating and very fun. And, of course, a lot of these things, as part of the editing, we would play test them to see, you know, are there gaps in here, things that aren't explained or that need to be gone into in more detail or just aren't working and that we have to take out and that sort of thing. So from that standpoint, you know, being an editor is the next best thing, I guess, to, you know, to being one of the top creators involved in that sort of thing. So I think I had some good ideas, and they came out fairly well, but I would certainly step aside in deference to the greater creative minds that I had the pleasure and the privilege of working with.
Okay. Glenn, you're up with some questions?
Yeah, I think I do. Who were some of the more, like, while you were there, interesting people who worked at TSR, and what kind of things you remember about them?
It was a really incredibly creative bunch who loved gaming, and as people came at the call of TSR, you know, from far off places, they would each bring interesting backgrounds and new perspectives, and you know, it was just a tremendously interesting bunch of people and fun to play with, and you can imagine the pleasure of playtest sessions and that sort of thing. a couple names popped to mind. Well, quite a few. I mean, Tom Wam, just an amazingly creative guy, inveterate game designer, always a font of ideas, and some of his creations, you know, are classics. The Awful Green Things from Outer Space pops to mind. But he's also a guy who's got a portfolio of games that, you know, probably should be well enjoyed and popular today, but for one reason or another haven't, you know, had reached that audience. Skip Williams was a native of Lake Geneva. He's a year or two younger than I am, and, well, maybe a few more years younger than, you know, that he got involved and became quite a D&D aficionado as ye olde sage. Worked with Jim Ward, who was from Elkhorn, not far from Lake Geneva, and knew Gary from way back. And, of course, he's the designer of Metamorphosis Alpha and Gamma World. Pretty amazing font of ideas. What a creative mind he has. Mike Gray, who is still in the gaming business, works with Milton Bradley, came and was involved in some of the board games and stuff and did editing, and still is with Hasbro to this day. Massive game collection. Pretty interesting guy.
Wow.
The artists, the collection of artists, Dave Sutherland, of course, was the original artist on staff. Dave Trampier, Larry Elmore, amazing artist to this day, still active, and just remarkable. I love his stuff. Errol Otis came, I think, from the Bay Area, and we had a lot of fun with him. Colorful guy. And Lawrence Schick, John Pickens, let's see who else. Mark Akers, Tim Kask, of course, Dragon, editor, colorful guy, enjoyed playing enjoyed playing Fighting Skies with us, too. We'd play in his basement. So, I know I'm being maybe a little vague there, but quite a cast of characters. Harold Johnson was involved after I left there and did a lot of the rules editing and was in charge of the creative side of things. And he was quite an interesting, colorful guy.
And, wow. There's quite a cast of characters you had to work with.
Yeah, I think what all these people had was, you know, they were interested in the gaming hobby. Maybe a couple of the artists came from, you know, from an illustration background, but kind of got their feet wet and enjoyed what they did once they got there. But really, most everybody else just had a love of gaming, and that, you know, came through and was just a pleasure to work with and a lot of fun. So, it was great.
It must, you know, when you left in 83, it must have been really hard just to leave that kind of creative, fun atmosphere. What happened? What led to that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. There was a, you know, big spurt of growth from the 70s into the 80s, and there was, I think, a series of unfortunate business decisions kind of led to overexpansion and then a contraction of the business, which was unfortunate. Even though a number of these business decisions didn't work out, I think the goal of diversifying TSR became you know, a reasonable goal, and they wanted to, instead of just being a role-playing game company, wanted to broaden their appeal, maybe get some other products, enter some other markets, and so on. But it was a kind of a mixed bag in terms of what worked and what didn't, and when business slowed down, you know, it led to
layoffs
and so on. You know, they wanted to go into miniatures production. I think, I know it always seemed to bother Gary Gygax and Brian Bloom that, you know, some of these miniatures companies were doing so well based on the success of Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to license that, and ultimately, well, maybe we can bring this in-house and we can produce that, and that involved a tremendous amount of expense and space and manpower, and you need sculptors, and then you need people. They also wanted to branch out further in hobby shops, and they took on this GNW needlework product line that you know, didn't seem to catch on. And you know, again, it was certainly a diversification, and it was in the hobby business, but you know, I think that became a burden. They wanted to do their own manufacturing and assembly of games, again, to maybe cut costs, but, you know, maybe ultimately cut costs, but there's a lot of overhead involved in that. As you may recall, they did an acquisition of SPI.
Yeah.
Historical games.
Yeah.
SPI had fallen upon hard times. a very controversial business decision in the fact that they purchased the assets but not the liabilities of this corporation. And SPI, I think, was going into bankruptcy at that time, so their creditors were not too happy with that. So they had a great remnant of that company and, you know, products and inventory and stuff. And then the magazine Strategy and Tactics, which I think John Pickens took over. But I think that, you know, that company and that phenomenon had maybe run its course a little bit. And, you know, if you're going to really make it fly, you got to devote a lot of manpower. And, you know, when your business is in decline, that's tough to do. So
sounds like they just spread themselves too thin there.
Yeah, there was, I think, a little bit of hubris involved, too. I mean, a couple times I'd hear Gary Gygax, Brian Bloom kind of say, you know, we have no competition, and which, in a sense, you know, was reflected the fact that TSR was the premier company, was the role-playing leader, and so on. But again, to have that kind of attitude, you know, you're setting yourself up for a fall, I guess, so to speak. It was, it was hard to leave. There was a first wave of layoffs, then a second wave, and a third wave, and I think that's when I was let go. So it was, you know, it was difficult, and fortunately, you know, it turned out well for me. I remember when I got the news, and I was one of a number of people, you know, being put out the door, so to speak, at that time. Alan Hammack said to me, he said, aren't you bitter? You're one of the early people here, and, you know, you've worked here for 7 years and kind of given your life to this place, and, you know, now they're letting you go. And I said, well, you know, you never know. This could be the, you know, this could be another door opening, or it could be a new kind of opportunity comes out of this. And boy, you know, maybe I was putting a good face on it, but that absolutely became the case. After I left TSR, I got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go into the investment business. That's a whole other story and quite a phenomenon in itself. But you know, it absolutely was the case. So when one door closes, at least in theory, another one opens, and that, you know, that became true for me. And I guess the last thing I'd have to say is I always tell people the bad news is that they had to cut the staff from 300 employees to 100 employees, but the good news is they did save the company, and that's absolutely true. I mean, they were able to, you know, keep things going. And after I left, you know, there were battles over control of the company and other rather unpleasant elements in some regard. But, you know, they did keep it going, and we still got D&D today, so who's to say that it didn't work out?
Oh. Yes, definitely. Okay, Mike, Stuart?
Yeah. Getting back to Gen Con, you had already mentioned how you first started at Gen Con, but you're reputed to be the only person known to have made every single Gen Con ever. How did you manage to keep going every single year all that time?
It's been a pleasure, I can say that, but I have to block out my summer calendar every year and make sure that I'm there for that. You know, as you know, it was started by Gary Gygax and came out of the IFW and that sort of thing. Interestingly, not long ago, a few weeks ago, I was going through some boxes. I came across I don't want to call it a program book. It's more of a flyer stapled together. I've got two copies of it from Gen Con 2, 1968. So it was a trip down memory lane. But my original attending the convention was a family vacation. I was in high school, and I said to my parents, hey, they're having this gaming thing in Lake Geneva. It's only 300 miles from the Twin Cities. Could we maybe go down there? I'd like to go to this thing. It's a Saturday. And by the way, Lake Geneva's got a great setting with boat cruises, and there's other stuff to do there. And fortunately, bless their hearts, my parents agreed, and my sister tagged along, and off we went to Lake Geneva, and they enjoyed a day of vacation there while I was gaming my heart away all day long. That was August 24th, 1968, and a day that will live in memory. And so since then, I've always tried to go every year. Obviously, when I worked at TSR, I was involved in a lot of different things. The greatest challenge was in 1986 when I was married, end of July, and the convention was coming up, and planned our honeymoon, and I was coming back on Saturday night from San Francisco back to Milwaukee so that I could go to Gen Con on Sunday, which I did, keep my streak going. And my wife, bless her heart, was agreeable to that. But even before that, I think, oh man, what if the plane's canceled, or, you know, I can't get out. I'm out of San Francisco to get to Milwaukee, and I'm going to miss Gen Con at least one day. And,
how do you explain that one to your wife?
One other year when I had a business conflict with my subsequent job, But I was able to get down there for a day or two and then get back to what I had going on here. So it's been a little bit of a challenge, but really, really a pleasure, and it's just been great. And you know, it's something that I'm proud of. It's a pretty minor claim to fame, but I enjoy being the person that's been at all of them. And
I'm envious.
I still love it.
Well, you didn't just attend a lot of the Gen Cons. Do you do judging or other activities?
Yeah, I still do. You know, it started out, even Gen Con 1 ran Fight in the Skies game in 1968. And Dawn Patrol, in fact, it predates Dungeons and Dragons. It's, you know, it's really the only game that's been on the Gen Con schedule every single year for all these years. And that's, you know, something that
I didn't know that. He's
rather proud of. And, you know, we're already lining up events for 2011. So I've always been involved in that. Most years running Dawn Patrol, we have an event called, it's the Saturday game. It started out originally as the, you know, this was before the game was even called Dawn Patrol. The Saturday morning event at Gen Con was called the Dawn Patrol. In our younger and crazy days, we actually started the game at 7 in the morning, which means you got to roll out of bed at 6 and try to get breakfast and get over there. But that was kind of a tradition until we got a little older and wiser, and we still run a Saturday game, which one year at when the convention was at Parkside, we built as world's largest Dawn Patrol, and it actually was. We've never had a game as big. We had 42 players. We had three boards of seven against seven, so 14 at each board, and they were side-by-side air battles, seven against seven, and then after a certain number of turns, you could fly from one board to the other. We had I was the overall judge. We had a judge at each of the tables. We had four judges and 42 players. And the name has stuck, World's Largest Dawn Patrol. In fact, it might still be on the Gen Con schedule at that, but that's become the Saturday game. So that's always been part of it. I ran Don't Give Up the Ship miniatures. That's the set of rules that I was involved with Gary and Dave in creating. I did the historical scenarios for that. I ran Top Secret, obviously, as I mentioned. Some of the other games, TSR and other, ran Rail Baron, Avalon Hill, Rail Baron, Parker Brothers Pit card game, which is a great game. Divine Right was one of TSR's board games. We ran a tournament of that. That's a great game, by the way.
Yeah, I love Divine Right.
And then, that's kind of a forgotten classic. Anybody who's listening to this who is not familiar with Divine Right, I'd say track down a copy and get four or five of your friends. The more the merrier, and enjoy yourselves. It's just a great game. And then in 1976, which was Gen Con 9, I created a variant of the Avalon Hill Le Mans game called Giant Le Mans, and we ran that in a four-hour simulation of the 24-hour race in France for the first time, and then I ran that a number of years subsequently.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that Giant Le Mans was on the old Avalon Hill rules or a modified.
Yeah, it's a variant, kind of a big expanded version. The original game came out in 1961, and it's, you know, a typical board game where you can set it on top of a table, and these model cars are pretty small. But I kind of thought it would be a great thing to maybe do on a large scale, and I don't remember what year, in the late 60s, the movie, Steve McQueen movie, Le Mans came out, or Le Mans, if you prefer, the French version, and that was a tremendous motion picture, still very entertaining to this day, and that got me all fired up to want to go to France and see the real race someday, which I did with my friend Jim Barber in 1976, and while we were there, of course, I had just started at TSR in the spring, in March, and now we're in France, and in June of 76, we're at the real race, pretty cool thing, in the city of Tours, which is about 40 miles from Le Mans. We were at a hobby shop, and I saw all these model cars, and I thought, oh, man, this is ideal. This is great. I got to get these cars. Well, you know, we were on a shoestring budget and didn't have much money. I probably spent $75 to buy probably 15 of these model cars, small scale, and then brought them back and then got poster boards and created this big, you know, Le Mans board game on a grand scale, which we unveiled at the 1976 Gen Con 9. And it was a hit, and expanded from there. We ran a six-hour version, a series of, I think, about a dozen races in Milwaukee with a bunch of players on, you know, a continuing basis. Then we created an eight-hour version to run at the convention where we'd have team drivers. Originally at 4 hours, you know, you would have a car and you'd run it for 4 hours. We did an eight-hour version with team drivers, kind of simulate the real-life sort of thing. That was a hit at the convention. And then, believe it or not, we people would say, well, this is an 8-hour thing is really cool. Would you ever do a 24-hour race? Well, I don't know. But being gamers, that a piece of what was on, I think 1980, at the Dutch shop in the basement, we ran a lot of race. We started at noon on Saturday, went around the clock, noon to Sunday. We had about 50 players, if you can believe that, in teams of two or three. I remember I went out in the 8th hour. I was judging and then also playing as one of the team drivers. And we did that again in 1992, 10 years later. There we had, I think we had 25 or 30 players the second time. And so we run this. It's a convention game, and going to bring it out again at GaryCon this next spring. So if anybody wants to take part in a game that really harkens back to the old days, that's going to be your opportunity next March at GaryCon.
Cool. You started that at Gen Con 9, you say?
Yeah, 1976, that's when it started, 4-hour version, and now, you know, we can play it, you can play it in a 4, 5, 6, 8-hour, or 24-hour version in the grand scheme of things. But it's a big logistical undertaking to put this thing on. We've got somebody mans the scoreboards, you've got one or two judges, somebody's monitoring the pit stops. It's kind of cool, though. We have everybody that plays as a driver's got a clipboard. You got all of your car stats on it, and there's a driver vest. Paul Schwab is one of the guys who would judge it with me, and to the credit of his wife, she made all of these. She sewed up a bunch of driver vests, bibs, so to speak. And when you're behind the wheel, we put the, you know, if you got the red number 26 car, you put the red number 26 bib on and tie it around your around your waist, and it's got a 26 front and back on a red panel, and that shows that you're behind the wheel. And they hand you the clipboard, and you're off to the races, literally and figuratively. And so when you come into the pits to give off to the driver, you take the vest off, hand it to the other guy, give him the clipboard, he takes over, you decide if you're going to refuel or, you know, change the tires and that sort of thing, and away you go. So it's a greatly expanded version of what was a pretty cool Avalon Hill game. So it's really a crowd pleaser. It's a great convention game because, you know, the board is 12 feet long and 8 feet wide, and it takes a bunch of tables, and you've got a bunch of guys milling around with these vests on, and scoreboards going, and, you know, judges shouting, new turn, move, and... Yeah. You know, it's quite a spectacle. So, but it harkens back to the olden days. So, it's kind of a fun thing.
So, did you run it at Gen Con 10 at the infamous Gen Con at the Playboy Mansion?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did. We did an 8-hour version there with team drivers, and I remember I was taking a break and was with one of the drivers, and we were having supper, I think, because I had a couple other judges, so I didn't have to be there every single minute. So. I'm going to take a dinner break. I go on and meet one of my friends who's, you know, his team driver is off driving, and we're in the middle of supper, and his team driver comes, you know, to the restaurant, and he goes, "What are you doing here?" And he goes, "You know, we're out. We crashed. We're done." So that was kind of fun. I still remember that. So that was quite a convention at that was at the Playboy Resort, which was one of the biggest facilities in Lake Geneva after Gen Con outgrew Horticultural Hall, and they had across the alley from Horticulture Hall, was the Guild Hall, was part of a church there. So they had some events there, but eventually it just got too big. And so they were casting about where could we have this. And, of course, Playboy Resort was the premier resort in that area, which had an additional cachet because of the Playboy name and so on. So that's where they had Gen Con 10. And it was quite a...
But only that great, one.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a gathering. Well, after that, I think they moved to Parkside. UW, University of Wisconsin Parkside campus, which is about 35 miles east near Lake Michigan in the Racine Kenosha area. And Gen Con was at Parkside for a number of years after that. It just kept getting bigger and bigger. But it was pretty legendary. That's you know, something we all look back at fondly. I mean, the resort's a pretty classy place, had great food. There was a big exhibition hall, and that was really the first time I think Gen Con really had a big dealer or what would be the start of a large dealer area. The cool thing, obviously, for all of us as young males was the fact that there were Playboy bunnies as waitresses at the restaurants and so on. So that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, how many people do you think showed up to that one specifically for the hopes of seeing the Playboy bunnies,
well,
as opposed to just gaming?
It probably was a very positive help. In drawing some attendance. Yeah, it was great. It was a memorable event. You know, I've been to all these Gen Cons, and a lot of them kind of fade together in my memory, whether they were at Parkside or elsewhere, but that's certainly one I'll never forget. And it was fun. And we did run I think it was probably the first time we ran the 8-hour version of the Giant Le Mans, which was a success. And players would ask about it. We kind of developed a following of that over the years. And then we didn't play for a while in the late 90s and into the decade of 2000. We kind of lost our cadre of players. So there's been a number of requests. So, you know, we're bringing it out, and we ran it at Gary Con for 4 or 5 hours last year. And I think, you know, we're going to try to do an 8-hour version this year. And they promised to help promote it and stuff. So I wrote a long blurb, which is going to be on the Gary Con website. Hopefully we can draw some people out. You know, younger gamers may have wondered, you know, what was it like in the old days, you know, before they were around on the scene. And so it's kind of fun to bring something like this back. And, of course, I'd invite all four of you if you want to come and play.
Oh, I'd love to.
We'll do that as well. So it's a throwback. That'd be great. And we're gonna build it as a throwback, and we're going to have some fun with it. So.
I think with the invention of 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, that a lot of the newer generation, maybe being disappointed, have come back to basic D&D or Classic or 1st edition saying, wow, this is kind of cool how these guys played it back in the day. Let me try it. I mean, there's been a real big reinsurgence of the old games coming back into the market now with all clones and everything. And yeah. I mean, lots of people listen to this podcast because they want to know how it was back in the day. Thus, we ask questions to people like you so you can tell us what happened back then.
Yeah, and I wish I had more vivid recollections about some of the details. I know, I've seen the blogs and some of the website stuff, and, you know, everybody's really very interested in not only the big picture, but sometimes the minutia of it, and, you know, that's where I'm lacking, so I apologize in that regard. Hopefully I can convey some of the feel of how it was in those days, if not the actual details of armor class and where did this or that particular rule come from, so... Hopefully there's some entertainment value at least in
oh, definitely. A lot of good information. Yeah. We have a couple more questions for you, Mike, and then we'll let you go. How do you think Gen Con's changed over the past 40 years? From the first day its conception up until now, is it a different feeling when you go now than you did back in the day, or is it just the same good old, yeah, Gen Con?
Well, there's a little bit of that. I mean, it's still Gen Con, and it's still going to be a great time. So from that standpoint, yeah, you know you're going to go to Gen Con, you're going to have fun, and boy, the more friends that you can bring along, the more fun you're going to have. Of course, you're going to see friends or people you know from other years, from other places. And so, you know, that part hasn't gone away. In fact, it's, you know, on a much bigger scale. I think the best thing about Gen Con today is that, you know, you've got endless choices for gaming. I mean, almost no matter what you're interested in, you know, there's going to be something that appeals to you. And one of the great traits of Gen Con from day one is the fact that if you want to run a game or introduce a game to other people, you know, you can get on the schedule and you can have an event and you can judge the thing and promote it the way you like. And, you know, that hasn't changed at all. That's really, you know, from the very start. And obviously that helped me expose, you know, this fledgling game of Dawn Patrol to a handful of people, started out with a few dozen and, you know, grew from there. So that's been great. I think nowadays Gen Con's all-encompassing. It's just a huge event. It's overwhelming, you know, to all of us, I think, but in a really positive way. I mean, the coolness of it is, you know, the scope of it, and that's great. And moving to Indianapolis, as much as I hated to see Gen Con move out of my backyard, by that I mean southeastern Wisconsin, you know, leaving Milwaukee, Indianapolis is just fantastic. It's a tremendous facility. It's a great location. You know, my only complaint is I got to drive through Chicago and, you know, mess with the traffic to get there. But, what a great setup it is, and I really want to take my hat off to, you know, Peter Atkinson and, you know, what he's done with that property, so to speak. And, I mean, he loves Gen Con himself, and, you know, it shows. I mean, it's a great event. And, you know, there was some question over the years, you know, could Gen Con be sustained? Could, you know, the people in charge keep it going? And, you know, bless their hearts, they did. It's, you know, great. I'm sure there's some unsung heroes along the way that, you know, have helped sustain this. And, you know, now it's 40-plus years and, you know, continuing to gain in stature and history and reputation. So it's just a great thing. I still enjoy it and look forward to it.
Do you ever foresee Gen Con moving again, or you still think they'll be in Indianapolis for a long time?
I think it's going to be there for a long time. I know they've done like a 5-year contract. And,
yeah.
You know, it's in the center of the country. I mean, obviously, I like it because it's not that far. I can drive there pretty easily. You know, if people come from the coast, central location does have some value, you know, and it's not Chicago. And so Indianapolis is a great city in a lot of respects. And, you know, the number of hotels, which I heard was the main reason that, you know, they were moving out of Milwaukee. They just kind of maxed out the lodging capabilities. You know, gamers were staying at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the dorms for a while.
Wow.
That may have changed. Also, the convention center in Milwaukee, the Midwest Express Center now, whatever, that's Frontier Airlines has taken over. There's too many mergers, can't keep them straight.
Yeah.
That was a big facility, but it was kind of poorly designed, the way the meeting rooms were, and, you know, it was adequate for the convention. But, boy, in Indianapolis, it's just dynamite. You know,
yeah.
Everything's fantastic, and the restaurants are just, you know, two blocks away or less, and, you know, the hotels are clustered right around there, and you got the football stadium now, you know, within two blocks. And,
yeah.
You know, it's just, it's unbeatable. I can't see them moving out of there, partly because it's centrally located and also because the facilities are just, it's collectively as a package, unbeatable in my opinion.
I had a great time going to Gen Con this past year. And the only thing that really bothered me was the construction, because you had to walk certain areas. You couldn't walk certain areas. It was like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess it was that time of the year for them, so.
Yeah, it's great.
So what have you been doing these days for work as far as gaming-wise, or have you been doing any gaming publishing or working any products out there? Or?
I'm continuing to, I guess, dabble in the gaming hobby. I'm still obviously involved in Dawn Patrol World, and as the guru of Dawn Patrol, you know, have hopes of doing an 8th edition of the game, and we've got a number of people who, you know, made some contributions, done some tremendous research, and some of these people who love this game are just remarkable, and I'm sure you see that in other areas of the gaming world, that you really go above and beyond to do the research and make suggestions, and that's a game that's always involved, you know, input from the players that I would consider and so on. So I'm involved in that gaming. After I left TSR, I went into the investment business, answered an ad in the Wall Street Journal for commodity futures trader, and that's a whole other story, but I had kind of a similar experience. Gentleman put together a group called the Turtle, which became nicknamed later as the Turtles, and trained us to trade commodity futures and gave us a good stake of his money to do that with.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And a pretty remarkable situation. So I was in that business for a while, and then when that particular program ran its course, I was individual investment advisor, commodity trading advisor, did that with my own business for a while, and that eventually, although I was halfway successful at it, eventually went into another direction and went back to freelance writing, which was my original intention when I left TSR, having authored The Robbers and Robots and a couple other books. I was going to try my hand at freelance writing, which is quite a challenge because it doesn't pay much, but I've gone back to freelance writing, did some of that. That led to a corporate job where I worked with Generac Power Systems. They make standby generators of all sizes. One of the top producers of that. They're right in southeastern Wisconsin here. Worked in marketing communications for them for 7 years. And now I'm back to freelance writing. And I write about snowmobiling, which has always been a hobby of mine since way back, with travel articles. I still do some work for Generac. I do the employee newsletter and that sort of thing, writing. And then one of the offshoots, I work for the Kern Family Foundation. Gentleman who founded Generac and ultimately sold the company, to his credit, formed the foundation and is in the process of giving away his fortune for some very worthwhile causes, one of which is supporting Project Lead the Way. It's a pre-engineering program for middle schoolers and high schoolers. So I'm writing about Project Lead the Way and kind of cobbling together an income from these sorts of things, keeping my hand in gaming as a hobby.
Okay, cool. Anybody have any last-minute questions for him?
No, that should do it.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
We appreciate you coming on.
I do want to encourage people that are listening to this to come to GaryCon. It's just a great honor in memory of Gary Gygax, in Lake Geneva and every spring. So, in part of that, they're trying to raise money for a dragon statue, which obviously anybody interested in D&D has to get behind that. So I would encourage anybody that's interested to make a donation to that project as well. So,
is there any way? I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was saying, is there any way someone could follow you on the web, or do you have a website or a blog or
even an email address?
There's a dawnpatrol.org website that some of the game people involved in Dawn Patrol are involved with, and they get hold of me through that.
Okay. Okay, are you on Twitter or anything, or on Facebook that people can find you?
No, I'm trying to remain old school for as long as I can.
Yeah, I was dragged into Facebook kicking and screaming.
I get enough email, it, you know, burns up enough of my time without expanding it voluntarily. So maybe it's just a matter of time, but at the moment, no. I'm enjoying a peaceful, sedate life without being too electronic.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Definitely. Well,
less is more, maybe, I don't know.
Well, Mike, thank you for joining us for this interview, and we appreciate all the time you spent with us and all the history you've given us for your what you've been doing.
Yes, it's been wonderful. I hope it's been happily interesting.
Oh, definitely.
Thanks for your time.
All right. Well, again, I appreciate your interest in what I have to say, and I hope it's been entertaining at least.
Definitely.
All right.
Take care.
All right. Thank you all.
Take care, Mike.
Take care.
All right. Keep up the good work with your blog.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Take care.
If you have any comments, please email saveordiepodcast@gmail.com or visit saveordie at saveordie.info. Follow the cast on Facebook/saveordiepodcast or follow them on Twitter @theevildm.